Good day, and welcome to the Amyris Virtual Investor Mini-Series. All participants will be in listen-only mode. Should you need assistance, please signal a conference specialist by pressing the star key followed by zero. After today's presentation, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. To ask a question, you may press star then one on your touchtone phone. To withdraw your question, please press star then two. You may also submit a question via the webcast by clicking the Ask Question button. Please note, this event is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to Han Kieftenbeld, Chief Financial Officer of Amyris. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chad, and good morning and good afternoon, everyone. With me today are John Melo, President and Chief Executive Officer, and Sunil Chandran, Senior Vice President, Research and Development. Today's webcast is the first session in the Amyris Virtual Investor Mini-Series. The theme for the series is Delivering on the Promise of Synthetic Biology. And today, we will feature our proprietary science and technology platform. During this call, we will make forward-looking statements about future events and circumstances, such as those related to future transactions, financial performance, operating activities, market opportunities, and growth prospects. These statements are based on management's current expectations, and actual results and future events may differ materially due to risks and uncertainties, including those detailed from time to time in our filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Amyris disclaims any obligation to update information contained in these forward-looking statements, whether as a result of new information, future events, or otherwise. Before we begin today, I'd like to know that included in our webcast is a slide presentation we will refer to in today's presentation. The slides are also posted on the Investor Relations section of Amyris's website. During our hour together today, John will provide a business update, followed by a 30-minute technology overview by Sunil, and we will conclude with a 15-minute Q&A session. I'll now turn the call over to John Melo. John?
Thanks, Hein. Good morning and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining today. We'd really prefer being with you in person, and I look forward to the day soon when that will be possible while keeping us all safe and healthy. 2020 has been a year of extreme uncertainty. We're very fortunate that it has also been one of the most productive years in the company's history, where we have transformed our business, accelerated our industry leadership, and are well advanced to becoming the first fully funded business in our sector. I'm very thankful for the support of our investors and the resilience, collaboration, and innovation of our teams and partners, working jointly to meet the needs of consumers and respond to the world's need for a much more robust response system to global pandemics. While we recognize this year has not been perfect, we have continued to focus on delivering industry-leading operating and financial performance. We have had several setbacks where we were unable to ship what we planned the last few quarters. This is part of pioneering new technology and processes during a global pandemic, but nonetheless, an important lesson in becoming better at setting and communicating expectations while continuing to deliver outstanding operational performance. For today's business update, I'll cover three items. First, an update on the transactions that we referenced during our last earnings call. Secondly, a review of our portfolio. And then thirdly, a look at the road ahead for Amyris. Let me start with an update on our transactions. We previously mentioned that we are actively working on three transactions covering four components of our portfolio. We previously indicated a total value of $350 million across the contemplated transactions. I am pleased to report that we've made significant progress since our November earnings call. We have successfully advanced the total value to over $450 million for the three transactions. The $450 million value represents a combination of upfront payments, milestone payments, and royalty arrangements. The first transaction is an exclusive license valued at $50 million for the use of farnesene to produce one molecule. This agreement is signed. Closing is expected over the next 10 days, pending approval by the board of directors of both companies. We expect around 75% of this transaction's value to be recognized as revenue in the fourth quarter. We will provide more details on this transaction when we issue a press release announcing the closing. The other transactions have signed term sheets with agreement on the key business terms and are moving through due diligence and contracting at this time. We expect two additional transactions to be completed by the end of the first quarter. The upfront portion of the three transactions combined is expected to be more than $200 million, with payments expected between now and the end of the first half of 2021. We see a clear path ahead that is strategic and value accretive for all parties involved. I'd like to now review our portfolio. Through this process of these transactions, we have developed a clear understanding of the current market value of our assets and technology. We believe there is a significant gap between our current equity valuation and the market value of our assets and technology. Our portfolio strategy is to simplify and focus our activity while monetizing parts of the ingredients portfolio that are delivering less than 50% annual growth, have a longer cash cycle, and are on the lower end of our gross margin hurdle rate of a 50% pro forma gross margin. We believe we are 3 to 5 years ahead of other sector peers and competitors in terms of number of molecules commercialized, number of molecules with an engineered and proven pathway ready to commercialize. Think of this as our technology pipeline and related TAM, our recurring revenue growth rate, and our gross margin profile. Our go-forward combined consumer and ingredients product portfolio is expected to continue at the current growth rate with a pro forma gross margin above 50%, along with a much shorter cash cycle. Our R&D and process development functions have been very productive this year, with 6 new molecules and a significant expansion of our R&D pipeline. Our 6 new molecules are vanillin and flavors, CBG, biosilica, retinol, squalene, and bonsucru ethanol for the personal care industry. This is double the target we set for 2020 of 2 to 3 new molecules to market. These new molecules are expected to generate 2021 revenue that is close to 2 times the 2020 revenue attached to the molecules we are monetizing through these transactions. The transactions have provided us with a sound market-based current valuation of our assets. Regarding our consumer portfolio, our target markets have a TAM of approximately $250 billion. We are growing the consumer part of our business at 3 times this year against a stated target of 2 times annually. We estimate our consumer business to have a market value of around $800 million based off our current annualized revenue run rate. Based on the attained valuation of the ingredient products we are monetizing, we believe that the combination of our existing ingredients portfolio and the addition of 6 new molecules to have an estimated valuation greater than $1 billion for our ingredient products. Beyond the 6 new molecules I mentioned, we have a current development and scale-up pipeline of 18 molecules that should attract future valuations, similar to what I just described. Also, our technology platform has successfully engineered yeast capable of producing at least 250 different molecules through 20 different biological pathways. Additionally, we have designed pathways but not yet produced for 200 molecules. This is a total potential of 450 molecules that are at different phases of current development. This inventory of strains and molecules ready to develop and scale, should we decide to commercialize, represents a suggested current market value of over $10 $1 billion. Think of our technology platform as the operating system for making clean chemistry and remaking the world a healthier place, kind of like Windows or the Apple OS or Tesla batteries operating logic. We are the equivalent for remaking chemistry. Recognizing the full value of our technology can be challenging since it's not immediately visible in day-to-day products. Already, more than one-third of you are likely consuming a product with an Amyris sustainable molecule inside at some low content level. Clean chemistry will continue to become a bigger component in applications for everyday consumer products as consumers continue to demand more natural and sustainable solutions. Our future growth is about more molecules into more products and used at higher rates in each application, much like the Apple business model of getting the operating system and the device in your hands, and then becoming your everything, from music to your source of movies to your connectivity and your productivity tools. Our track record of monetizing molecules and our current use cases demonstrate that we have built an engine for continuous value creation. The more molecules we scale, the more efficient we become, and the more value we aggregate for the technology platform. So, how about the road ahead for Amyris? The successful completion of these transactions, combined with continued strong operational performance, establishes a clear path for self-funding. We do not have any current plans for major fundraising through debt or equity to meet our operational needs or to support our current growth. In 2021, we will be very focused on completing new Brazil manufacturing facility. Given our business progress and these transactions, we will need this production capacity to meet demand in 2022. We are focused on continuing our leadership position in clean beauty and personal care and healthcare markets with our leading consumer brands and the key platform ingredients that are making the personal care industry more sustainable. This is a business where we are fully integrated and own the value chain. We are expanding and deepening our partnerships to accelerate the number of molecules we are developing and scaling through collaborators outside of clean beauty, personal care, and healthcare markets. In summary, our business model is working. Our proprietary technology is delivering clean, sustainable solutions. Our technology is also demonstrating how valuable it is, as evidenced by our ability to monetize molecules that we have developed, scaled, and commercialized. We continue to improve and accelerate our time from lab to market to deliver our no-compromise products for a healthier planet. And that is the focus of the rest of our session. Let me now pass to Sunil, who will explain in more detail our technology platform. Sunil, so glad you're with us and looking forward to hearing your update.
Thanks, John, and hello, everyone. I would like to start by emphasizing that over the years, we have been continuously innovating and investing in our technology platform. Our first commercial product took about 40 months to go from strain to pilot plant run, and today we average less than a year. Our cost of product development has dropped by 90%, our time to market has reduced by 80%, and we have been able to do this by increasing the bandwidth of our R&D pipeline by 500% since 2012, while increasing OPEX by only 20%. Today, our goal is to walk you through the integrated Amyris R&D PD manufacturing technology platform. At Amyris, our goal is to disrupt conventional production systems that rely on destructive and non-sustainable practices and replace them with highly scalable, clean manufacturing powered by biology. Our platform enables our scientists to precisely engineer microbes like Saccharomyces cerevisiae to fermentatively convert sugar to a variety of ingredients that consumers use on a day-to-day basis. Using our technology platform, we can offer better performing ingredients at lower cost using a process that is far better for the environment. Now, in order to modify a microbe like Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which has evolved for billions of years to consume sugar to produce ethanol, we need to go through a highly iterative process where we design the strains, build the strains, test them, learn from the data, and based on that data, redesign the next set of strains. Now, biology being unpredictable, if we can only build and test a few strains at a time, we would need to go through a huge number of iterations through this pipeline, thereby increasing the timeline and investment needed for commercial success. We solve for this unpredictability using a proprietary lab-to-market operating system designed to continuously learn from previous iterations via highly optimized and automated molecular biology, analytical, and process development tools combined with machine learning algorithms and statistical models, enabling us to collect larger amounts of quality data. The final result is a fully integrated end-to-end R&D PD manufacturing solution that is built to disrupt how companies traditionally approach this problem. This integration means that today we start every project with the end in mind. And before we even start designing our first strain, we have a good understanding of our manufacturing process, our cost targets, and how we will get there. Today, we will walk you through this integrated pipeline in detail. So let's start with automated design, which is a proprietary programming package enabling us to access the chemistry in living systems and find the optimal biochemical route from sugar to the target molecule. Now, all living cells carry out a series of chemical reactions to convert sugar into a variety of molecules. Nature combines various chemical reactions into unique combinations to form routes or biochemical pathways. Hence, in order to engineer a microbe to convert sugar to a target molecule, the first step is to understand what reactions and routes we need to optimize within the microbe. At Amyris, we have built an atlas of all the living reactions that are known to occur in nature across multiple organisms, and we have invested considerable effort to understand how they are linked to each other. Now, the closest analogy that I can give you is that we have created the Google Maps for metabolic pathways. And just like we can ask for the most optimal route from, say, New York City to Boston from our mapping app, we can ask for the most carbon-efficient route from sugar to the target molecule. Now, just like our Maps app needs to keep track of one-way roads and shouldn't ask us to cross a river at a spot where there's no bridge, our computation program needs to keep track of reaction directionality, thermodynamics, and biological feasibility. The result isn't necessarily the shortest path from sugar to the target molecule, but the most efficient path, keeping in mind several biological limitations. The program will also calculate how much sugar can theoretically be converted to the product as shown here. So in this example, for every 100 grams of sugar fed, 23.8 grams are converted to the product. This number is important because it sets a biological limit on the manufacturing costs we can achieve at scale. Now, every biological reaction is associated with a DNA sequence, and our program will collate a list of all the DNA sequences needed to compile these reactions in our microbes. If a microbe were a software program, then you need multiple lines of code or commands to specify a program that introduces new functionality into the microbe, so that instead of converting sugar to, say, ethanol, the microbe starts executing a new program to convert sugar to, say, farnesene. To date, we have verified programs for greater than 250 molecules. Now, Amyris got its start by producing terpenes, and we have expanded this expertise beyond terpenes. Our strategy has been to invest a lot of effort in building platform strains that optimize the carbon flux to a common metabolic node that enabled us to access a wide range of subsequent molecules with only one or two genetic changes. Today, we have a suite of platform strains stored in our freezers, and when we decide to go after a target molecule, we already have a platform strains with a large number of the genetic bells and whistles already incorporated into the strain for that target molecule. Now, this multicolored wheel on the slide is a chemical dendrogram and represents more than 500 molecules classified by their chemical functionality into 15 distinct chemical classes. We now have a panel of platform strains allowing us to access all these 15 chemical classes, encompassing more than 20 biochemical pathways. We have to date gone after more than 500 target molecules and produced more than 250 of them. So today, if a partner comes to us with a target molecule in mind, we have either attempted and produced that exact molecule or a molecule that is only one or two steps from the desired target. Now, let's come back to the analogy of a microbe being a computer program and DNA being code. Well, software engineers don't code in zeros and ones. They use programming languages. So why should biologists code in A, T, G, and C? At Amyris, we have hence developed a programming language for DNA called Genotype Specification Language, abbreviated as GSL. So a single line of code, like the one shown here, fully specifies a DNA command containing thousands of base pairs, and the process is nearly instantaneous and error-free. So let's wrap up the design section by comparing where we were in 2008, where every design had to be manually curated and specifying 20 designs would take a scientist 3 weeks, to today, where that same scientist can come up with 1,000 designs in 10 minutes or less. Now, everything we have discussed so far has been the in silico process, and we now need to introduce the DNA designs into a yeast strain using our automated strain engineering platform so that the microbe can convert sugar into the target molecule. Let me start here by using another analogy. Most of us are familiar with Legos. Let's say I give you 10 Lego parts and ask you to make a Lego car. Well, that's easy enough. But suppose I give you 10,000 Lego parts and ask you to make 1,000 Lego cars for me. That suddenly becomes a challenge. However, what if I provide you with a database that contains all the parts and a software package that allows you to design all the cars? And that same software package associates all the parts with all the designs and provides all the instructions to mix the parts and assemble the cars on an automated workstation. Well, we apply the same analogy to strain construction. Every DNA part has a specific function, and we have a database of greater than 200,000 DNA parts and a software package that associates the parts with the designs and computes the robotic worklist to assemble the DNA designs. Let's continue with the Legos analogy a little more. Every Lego part has a unique function, but each Lego part can be connected to another part due to the compatible ends. We apply the same concept to DNA parts, and we introduce common sequences at the ends of all our DNA parts so that when different DNA parts are mixed in a single reaction, they come together in a predictable fashion to form the large target DNA design, which is then inserted into the strain. We currently assemble about 1,500 DNA designs per cycle and start a cycle every 2 weeks. So let's wrap up the strain construction section by comparing where we were in 2008, when all our strain construction operations were manual, to today, where we have applied a high level of automation to the whole process, resulting in a 1,000-fold increase in throughput, but with 100-fold lower costs. The next step in the lab to market pipeline is screening all the strains that have been generated. At Amyris, we generate more than 500,000 unique genotypes that result in about 7.2 million strain candidates in a year, which now need to be screened to find the strains that efficiently convert sugar to the final molecule. Think of this process as a giant funnel which sorts out the performing from the non-performing strain. At the end of the day, on average, only about 100 of the top strains are sent to fermentation per month. This screening process required a lot of investment in terms of development of proprietary statistical models and machine learning algorithms. You have to remember that the end state for our strains is performance in large fermentation tanks. But there isn't enough capacity in the world to test all our strains in fermenters. So we instead use 96 well culture plates to rapidly sort through the strains. When we first started measuring strain performance in plates and try to predict a fermenter tank performance based on individual measurements, the data is as shown on the left. On the x-axis is the performance in plates based on four different types of play datasets. The y-axis shows how those same strains performed in tanks. If the correlation between plates and tanks was good, you would expect the data points to cluster closer together along the line, but instead we see a complete scattering of the points showing poor correlation. The reason for this is obvious. The conditions in a plate are quite different from those in a tank. So in effect, it's the equivalent of trying to pick a world-class marathon runner, but you can only test your athlete using a rapid 100-meter race. So what we started doing is measuring multiple data sets and combining them all in a multivariate analysis model and using statistics and machine learning to predict tank performance. We not only measure the levels of our target molecules, but a whole range of intermediates that the strains produce en route to the target molecules, as well as side products that the strains may be making. When we started implementing these models, we started observing better correlation between our predicted and observed tank yields, as shown by the data points coalescing along a straight line in the right-hand graph. Today, we develop models like these for every new molecule project that we go through. So again, in 2008, we were working on a single molecule, only ran a single assay. And today, we run more than 30 assays for more than 18 molecules on any given day at a throughput that is 100-fold higher. And more importantly, we are collecting about 100-fold more data than we used to. While we consider our platform so far to be disruptive, the next phase is where we truly differentiate ourselves from other companies in our space. And this is our experience in traversing the valley of death that all companies need to go through when scaling up their strains and lab processes. When you think about where you start in the lab at 100 microliters and where we end up at 100,000 liters or more or higher, you're talking about a billion-fold increase in scale. And the transition from each step to the next is a failure point that can derail the entire project. We have been successful at managing these transitions with a well-developed fermentation pipeline where the data quality is robust and where we are measuring the right parameters to enable success at the next scale. Our experience with process development on 13 molecules has allowed us to develop lab-scale processes that mimic manufacturing scale, such that our performance translates perfectly across various platforms, as shown by the tight correlation in this graph, for real-world data, comparing our lab performance to commercial scale performance. What this means is that we can go from a half-liter tank directly to a 200,000-liter tank with high reproducibility, thereby reducing risk and cost and speeding time to market. So again, in 2008, we used to run standard 2-liter tanks and ran one process and had experience with just one molecule. Today, we run a wide range of high-throughput fermentation and purification systems and have developed more than 50 processes and have collected data for more than 50 molecules. Let's now see how this all comes together using RoboticideM or RebM as a case study. Amyris's RebM is a great-tasting, natural, non-GMO, zero-calorie sweetener with a market value of at least $2 billion. It is 200 to 400-fold sweeter than regular sugar, depending on the application and formulation, and a process results in a product with no bitter aftertaste. RebM is an extremely complicated molecule to make via fermentation, and yet our team has been able to double strain yield and productivity every 6 to 9 months, and we have now surpassed our original targets. And to emphasize just what it takes to achieve success in this space, this is what it took to double strain performance every 6 to 9 months. We had to optimize 8 different enzymes, screened about 100 genes per screen, and carried out 6 separate enzyme evolution projects. On the strain side, we introduced 17 novel enzyme activities that did not previously exist in yeast, altered 53 native genes, screened more than 500,000 strains, and ran more than 1,500 fermentations to find the right manufacturing candidates. and this doesn't even include the novel fermentation and downstream purification operations that our process development team implemented to drive cost down. So, to conclude, let's reiterate what we covered today. Since 2012, we have continued to deploy our industry-leading R&D, PD, and manufacturing platforms to the commercial-scale manufacturing of 13 different molecules. We have done this by continuously innovating in all facets of a fully integrated platform, allowing us to reduce product development costs and time to market. John, your thoughts on what we have communicated so far?
Thanks, Sunil. I really appreciate the overview, and I'm always in awe about the amazing power of biology, and it's John Doerr, our largest shareholder, always has a simple way to explain it. His view is, you feed these amazing bugs sugar, and they poop amazing molecules. The stuff in between is exactly what you just described, which is actually where all the magic is. And I think we're just scratching the surface. It's taken quite a bit to get here. I think a lot of times people bring up competitor names as like, oh yeah, they've got a great story and look at all the buzzwords they use. So how are you different? And everything you've just said and the metrics you just put out as to the progress we've made in lowering costs, increasing productivity and throughput, focusing on cycle time to learning, and always starting with the end in mind. Because at the end of the day, the technology only matters if it actually makes a product that makes the world better. And I think that is in spades what you and the team have done. And it's really appreciated. So thank you for updating us on all the amazing work. I hope that everybody was able to keep up with you. Without question, once we get through the pandemic and how we're living our lives, it'll be great to get folks back engaged in the lab to experience the amazing work you and the team have done. So let me now turn and make a few final comments on our thesis at Amyris. We think our thesis is pretty simple. Consumers are demanding natural products that are clean and sustainably sourced. This is true for all consumer goods, including beauty, personal care, health, and nutrition markets. We deliver better performing molecules at a lower cost, and they're sustainably sourced. We call this our no-compromise promise for customers and consumers. And this promise is delivering industry-leading growth. Said differently, every time we execute on our promise, the molecules we take to market become the leading molecules and the market share leader in their category. To make the world sustainable, our company needs to be sustainable. The simplification of our portfolio and our continued operational performance enables us to become one of the first companies in our sector to become financially self-sustaining. And I think that is game-changing for synthetic biology. We are very excited and pleased with this moment and the momentum in Amyris' life cycle. We welcome you to join our journey to creating a healthier and more sustainable planet through synthetic biology and fermentation. They need to go together to create real products that make a real difference, that drive value for everyone. Before we turn to Q&A, I wanted to let everyone know that we will make an effort to address everyone's questions, but also want to be mindful of time. Keep in mind, if we do not get to your question, please submit it to our investor relations email. And Peter, working with our partners at Argo, I'm sure will help get back to you as quickly as possible. With that, let me open the call up for questions and turn to Chad, our operator, to help facilitate that. Chad?
Thank you. Thank you, sir. We will now begin the question and answer session. To ask a question via telephone, you may press star then one on your touchtone phone. If you're using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the keys. To withdraw your question, please press star then two. To submit a question via the webcast, please click on the Ask Question button. We will begin with questions via phone. We ask that you please limit yourself to one question and one follow-up. At this time, we will pause momentarily to assemble our roster. And the first question will come from Doug Shankin with Cowen. Please go ahead.
Good morning and good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for taking our questions. Thanks for all the updates, both on the business opportunity as well as the monetization front. I wanted to really just ask a couple of questions on the financing and strategic events there. Just a cleanup question. I thought I heard in your prepared remarks that the full amount of the $50 million that you expect in the first transaction would be monetized as an upfront almost immediately, but then you talked about the 75% of the $50 million being recognized as revenue in the fourth quarter. Just to clarify, and either way, it's a win, but how much of the $50 million do you expect to receive in a cash flow up front?
Hey, Doug, first of all, thank you very much for being on the call and appreciate your feedback. And I'll, this is John, I'll start, and then Han, anything you want to throw in. We said a couple of things regarding the first transaction. First of all, that we expect about 75% of the $50 million to be recognized as revenue. Regarding the cash flow of the 50, we expect $30 million to be paid in immediately at the close, which we expect to be very soon, just pending really board approval by both companies. And then another $10 million to be paid by March 31st. So that's $40 million of the 50 to be paid, again, very quickly, 30 now, 10 by March 31st, and the rest of it is tied into a milestone payment. So I hope that helps, Doug, and clarify exactly how the 50 from a cash flow perspective impacts us. Han, is there anything else you want to add to that?
No, I think that's exactly right. No further comments on that.
Okay, that is super helpful. And then if I guess as a way to say compliant and only ask one more, I'll make it a two-parter. In terms of the next two term sheets, could you just talk about, you know, essentially what's left before close? And essentially what I'm trying to get at there is, you know, what type of due diligence do your partners require? And, you know, how would you characterize the associated risk there? So that's the first part, you know, kind of pulling all this together. I'm just wondering if you could help us out in thinking about, you know, how much 2020 revenue is expected to be divested over all of these transactions. It's exciting that the six new molecules you talked about are going to generate twice the revenue being divested in these transactions, but actually understanding, you know, essentially how much is moving out of the 2020 base would be really helpful. So first question is on diligence to get to a close, and the second is on revenue impact. Thank you again.
Yeah, I love that, Doug. You ended up getting a couple in there, but I appreciate it because they're actually great clarifying questions. So, look, when I say the term sheets are signed, these are pretty detailed term sheets. We actually worked quite a bit with both buyers to ensure we wouldn't have any surprises. So we've got, you know, detailed term sheets, all the business terms agreed. And obviously, they need to be translated into contracts, and that's work that's happening as we speak. Regarding the diligence, we don't see any significant concern around the diligence. There's normal diligence. We understand what the diligence is. We've been very clear and have shared the information. There are data rooms that have been available for a while to both of these partners. So I don't think there's, well, let me say it differently. I think the risk profile is the same of any other transaction we've been very confident about. It's obviously not done until it's done, but I don't suspect or expect any major issue, and really definitely not around the diligence. We do have to get them contracted, and that's obviously work. That's obviously work that needs to get done. Regarding the revenue, I believe the total revenue from all that we're divesting for 2020 is somewhere around the $30 million range. And again, as we said earlier, there was actually quite a bit more than 30, quite a bit more than double 30 built into the six molecules we're launching. And the six molecules we're launching are molecules that are now actually in production. We've demonstrated clear targets and deliverables, some of which are already delivering revenue this year. So actually, I think most of which are delivering revenue this year. So we feel very good about the visibility. We feel very good about how we're upgrading for a more consistent margin and a simpler manufacturing process for the new molecules. So I hope that helps. And Han, did I miss anything that we should correct?
No, I think that's framing it. That's framing it very well. As these transactions come to a conclusion, and we'll obviously give you clarity on all the details. But I think in order of magnitude, thinking about what is involved with these transactions and what comes, what goes, what stays, and what comes anew, you should have a good order of magnitude here.
Okay. Thanks, guys. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Doug.
And our next question is from Amit Bail with H.C. Wainwright. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning and good afternoon, everyone. Appreciate you taking my question. It was good to get a refresher on the impressive science behind the business again. So thank you for that. John, just to begin with, you had mentioned 450 molecules in inventory, I believe. Are these developed based on collaborations with customers, or are these sort of organic efforts that you might try to bring to the market, through partnerships, et cetera? Any color on how you, plan to sort of, leverage this asset base, I guess, going forward?
Yeah, no, thanks, Amit, and appreciate you being on the call. Look, I think the majority, and I'll ask Sunil to correct me after I make my initial comments if I don't get this right. I think the majority of the 450 were actually developed in a collaboration that we had with DARPA. DARPA really wanted to build out synthetic biology in a much deeper way as part of national security. And as part of that, they really wanted to focus on additional pathways, additional tools, and a lot more flexibility in what synthetic biology could do. So the number one benefit from having this inventory is actually the fact that we now have built out 20 pathways, more than 20 pathways, different classes of chemistry, and a real deep understanding of what biology can do and what it should do in places where biology and fermentation is a better path to make chemistry than what exists today. So the learning, the data, the tools, and the investment from DARPA were huge wins. I think the inventory just enables us to be faster to market. If you think about the last few molecules we've developed have all been kind of less than a year to get to a point where we've got a great strain ready to scale. And so that for me really, really proves the whole thesis around over time, different pathways, different organisms, different chemistry, being where the world ends up being with synthetic biology, and the funding from DARPA helped us get there. So I hope that helps. And regarding, new partners for the molecules, we're in active discussions. We're in active discussions with some of the world's largest consumer companies. And my guess is you'll just start seeing more partnerships and deeper relationships with current partnerships that continues our path of at least 2 to 3 new molecules scaled every year. Sunil?
No, you captured that perfectly, John. It was definitely a combination of the investment we got from DARPA, and then combining that with the lessons learned from the rest of our product portfolio that we had commercialized, right? So combining both of those together allowed us to what I like to call is a molecule agnostic platform today. You captured it perfectly. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Just one more from me, and I'll get back in queue. So for the last couple of years, the yearly performance has pretty much come down to, meeting 4Q expectations. With these monetization events that are planned, is this part of the story going to change in 2021?
Look, I mean, I think our growth rate quarter on quarter this year has been pretty phenomenal. I think we've been at a pretty constant click of about 20% or better quarter on quarter performance or growth in our product portfolio. We had said that, expect the fourth quarter to be much greater than that, and that is exactly how we're performing. We expect to meet analysts' expectations for the fourth quarter, and, we expect to have a great 2021. And I think the big difference is I don't see the fourth quarter being as much of a standout. It's still always a better quarter just because of seasonality in some of our business, but I don't expect it to be as much of a hockey stick next year for sure. I think secondly, and the biggest change is, we're not running from one fundraising to the other. We're not running from one bad debt structure to the other, and we're not taking a big chunk of our cash and using it to pay down debt. We actually are now at a point where the sustainable part of our business and how we're able to fund our growth and focus on delivering on our objectives, I think is really the freeing part of where we are. So I hope that helps. Not as much of a hockey stick in 21 for sure, fully funded, which changes our whole approach to how we look at the business, and then on track to meet expectations in the fourth quarter.
Well, thank you for that, John. I do have some follow-ups on this, but I will take it offline. Thank you.
Perfect. Thanks, Amit.
Thank you.
And the next question will come from Colin Rush with Oppenheimer. Please go ahead.
Thanks so much, guys. Given the accelerated time frame on the molecule development that you guys have seen this year, what are you seeing on the customer front in terms of, you know, interest level activity and folks that we know have been looking for support on the sort of molecule development and coming back to you guys and getting more serious about future programs?
Yeah, Colin, by the way, thanks for being on the call. It's a great question, and what I would tell you is we have obviously market leaders in segments where biology makes amazing chemistry, meaning pure, better performing, lower cost. And those market leaders, what I'd say, are taking more and more advantage of the platform to get to the objectives that they have, whether it's new molecules or whether it's the current molecules performing at a lower cost, whatever it may be. What I would tell you we're experiencing is just a deepening and broadening of collaborations with the current partners. There are some new partners coming to the mix, really because of our expansion into some areas like proteins and to the healthcare area. So we are seeing new partners, but I wouldn't say, Colin, and mainly because of our focus, that all of a sudden we're broadening and opening the floodgates to a bunch of new companies across a bunch of different industries. I think we're staying focused on, we know where the technology plays best. We have great relationships already with market leaders. We're adding a few, and we're really deepening with what's there today.
That's helpful. And then, you know, as you look at this growing number of molecules and accelerated pace, can you talk about the decision-making process that Amyris goes through in deciding which molecules to develop internally for their own brands, and how you guys think about working with partners to monetize the sale or the licensing of molecules?
I think for our own brands, and I'll start there, we're very focused on the market. We're very focused on where's the consumer and what is it that we have that can very quickly get to market and make a real difference. And I'll give you three different examples. Again, focused on clean beauty and personal care, which is really where we want to drive the chemistry for ourselves. I'll give you three examples that are very interesting. One comes out of the HMO work we've been doing. When you look at the HMO, the oligosaccharides are sit differently. The small sugars that exist in mother's milk actually have some amazing attributes beyond human nutrition and beyond the microbiome, the gut microbiome. There's a molecule, as an example, called L-fucose. L-fucose is an amazing molecule for wrinkle removal or wrinkle reduction. Wrinkle reduction and aging, we know, is a big, big deal for consumers. You can put me on that list. And I'm looking for products that are sustainable, that are healthy, that are naturally sourced, that actually do a great job removing wrinkles. L-fucose is a perfect example. We have a great way to make L-fucose, and it's a perfect example about how we leverage the platform. L-fucose is made through a pathway that's funded from a partner for HMOs, where we can actually go a little further in that pathway, be able to make L-fucose, and go into market and keep it for ourselves. That's one example. Another example is really RebM. One of the things we found is the yeast that makes RebM, with the RebM that's left, and some of the chemistry that's left, there's a class of molecules that's left in that RebM that actually is great for collagen production. It actually ends up producing collagen at double the rate of the best technology in the world today. So another example of we built for one, and we actually were able to leverage and apply it to the market we're in to be able to benefit and take it to market. The third example I'll give you is a bio-based or a sustainably-based preservative. You know, one of the things we have found in talking to a lot of our personal care partners is a great preservative that's natural is actually very hard to get. Most natural preservatives don't perform as well as the synthetic ones that are available. We've actually discovered one from our waste streams from the production of sugarcane and the processing of sugarcane. So to me, there's three examples of game-changing molecules that we're leveraging the technology from making things for partners that we could then extract some value and drive those and own those to the end market. So I don't know if that helps, Colin, just give you color into how we think about the portfolio and how we focus it on our own partners. And then I think regarding the partners, it's really things that they would like that we're not in the market for, and we don't want to invest in channel and market development that we're happy to use our platform for, because that's what our platform was designed and built to do.
That's super helpful, John. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks,
Colin. Before we take the next life question, there's a question that came in from Lawrence Alexander, who couldn't be live on the phone, from Jefferies. Let me quickly direct it to Sunil, perhaps. Sunil, here is the question. To what extent has the commoditization of data science, high-throughput screening, and genomics reduced the cost of duplicating Amyris's platform? Where do you see the most intractable bottlenecks or even areas of cost inflation for new entrants relative to what Amyris endured?
Got it. Well, great question. Thanks, Han. So, you know, I mean, there've always been off-the-shelf solutions, right, for data science, screening, genomics, automation, and what have you. The key to what Amyris has done is not the fact that we invested in these off-the-shelf solutions, but the fact that we integrated them into a cohesive end-to-end solution. So you might buy whatever packages are out there, but unless you can get them to work in a pipeline where each part of the pipeline talks to the other, you're going to be, you know, behind the curve, so to speak. So that's one part of it. It's not just individual operations. It's how they come together to form a single pipeline. The second part is, you know, we at Amyris, we end up, our automation solutions are proprietary workstations that our engineers have assembled on site through disparate pieces that they acquire. So again, these are not off-the-shelf robots that you can just, you know, buy and apply. We have developed a lot of proprietary work solutions. And finally, you know, the process development and manufacturing. We've talked about this a lot. You have to go through that experience to really understand what it takes to scale up a molecule. So that is something that you have to endure, and that will, you know, that is an area where Amyris has differentiated itself 13 times to date.
Yeah, okay. Sunil, I want to really add on to your last point, right, which is, you know, everybody uses the buzzwords and the tools are available, and, you know, I mean, like, buying DNA from Twist, it's fantastic, and it's something we shouldn't worry about. The industry should provide that. It's almost like I think of Twist as the Intel of the semiconductor industry. Like, they provide chips, we use those chips, it's all good. Actually, the place I think we've created the biggest bottleneck for the rest of the industry is having our own manufacturing, our own process development, and ensuring that every strain we scale can actually scale and be produced at a large plant. We have not had one failure of taking a final molecule to scale and producing it at a large plant since 2012. And I think that is the big differentiator. And we haven't seen anything emerge from our competitive set that would let us believe that anyone is close to figuring that out.
Yep, absolutely, John. Couldn't agree more.
Okay, that's great. Thank you both for addressing that question. Chad, I'll pass it back to you for the next life question over the phone.
Certainly. And that question will be from Randy Baer with Pinnacle. Please go ahead, sir.
What a great call. Sunil, that was very educational. Thank you and well done. John, I just want to drill down into two specific verticals that you've talked about during this year but haven't yet addressed on today's call. The first is adjuvants. I keep reading in the press about the limitations of the COVID vaccinations that are now approved and rolling out. I imagine the government is similarly concerned about scale and reach. So my first question is, does Amyris have a relationship today with Pfizer and or Moderna, and what would it take under Operation Warp Speed to introduce an adjuvant to those approved formulations?
Hey, Randy, thank you for being on the call. That's a pretty direct question. And like always, and I appreciate it, we obviously both through our mRNA license with IDRI and around the adjuvant have been in a lot of discussions with Operation Warp Speed over the last couple of weeks. And there have been discussions with some of those companies. I don't want to call anybody out specifically. And there is a lot of learning coming out of the last couple of weeks. So my only summary is to say it is clear that, one, what we have in the mRNA technology really does facilitate scaling and likely delivering a better mRNA technology that exists today. On the other hand, like being in market fast and getting treatments or vaccines to patients is so critical that I think these companies have done an amazing job focusing on time to market. And then, you know, the next generation, I think, will focus not only on time to market, but how to solve some of the problems that we now are aware of in some of these approaches. So I also want to be careful that I don't want to imply that there is that there will be a specific solution that we end up being able to support or help or engage with Moderna or with Pfizer. I really don't know whether that ends up being the case, which is different than our opinion as to whether it would be helpful. But I do know and can confirm that we are in discussions with several other pharma companies, and you will end up seeing our technology, both the adjuvant for sure, and then hopefully our mRNA technology. I'd say that part of it, we have more work to do in final products. So I hope that helps, Randy.
No, that's great. And I'll make sure my second question is much broader before I go back in queue. But you mentioned in your answer
okay,
to call.
That's okay.
No. But this is great. It's a great dialogue. You mentioned in your answer to Colin something that, you know, a lot of us that invest in the space have thought about for a long time, but Amyris has really only started to discuss, which is proteins, and specifically synthetic animal protein. So can you just tell us about where Amyris is with its efforts in the synthetic animal protein space? Is there a potential customer? Is it coming to market soon? Thank you.
Yeah, look, I'm going to pass this one to Sunil after giving you the commercial side and letting Sunil give you his perspective on the technology application. I think you'll see in the current transactions our move into proteins and how we think about partnership in that area. And I won't say any more on that because, again, we're in process of contracting. So that would be the first answer. Commercial is in play, and we expect to be complete by the end of the first quarter on the protein side. And then, Sunil, maybe on the technology side, you can provide a perspective on that.
Yeah, during the presentation today, we talked about RebM, right? And we talked about all the enzyme evolution and engineering we had to do to bring that product to market. We do that for pretty much every molecule we work on. So what that has resulted in is a robust enzyme optimization and engineering pipeline that we believe we can now apply towards protein production. So instead of, you know, trying to optimize 10 different proteins, focus on a single one, the tool set actually translates really, really well to that same platform. It also, you know, we've also dabbled in other organisms other than Saccharomyces cerevisiae that are more adaptable for protein production. So the platform is set up right now for us to accelerate, in this space. So it's a natural transition for us from small molecules to proteins, and the platform is well set up for that.
Look, I think the other piece, Sunil, that you've been very helpful for me in thinking about the strategy is actually how we leverage the platform, or said differently, evolve the platform when we can make it a play around two potential types of technology. So the idea that the platform can do proteins in the same section or area of the platform is also similar to what we will use for monoclonal antibodies as a way to really leverage investment. And this goes back to exactly my example in L-fucose. We get to L-fucose by developing the HMO pathway. The HMO pathway is with one partner, and we'd like to take L-fucose to market. I think when you think about monoclonal antibodies and proteins, it's that same kind of direction, but obviously much bigger market opportunities for two different categories of proteins, right? So just wanted you to be able to also reference that.
Yeah, the antibodies is definitely a space where we have worked in, right? We actually have even published the work in that space where we actually produced monoclonal antibodies like Herceptin in some of these hosts. So this is not new space for us. We've actually made a lot of progress here, and that's definitely a market we are interested in pursuing in the near future.
Great. Thanks, Sunil. Randy, I hope that helps. Next question, I think, right?
Yes, and that next question is from Graham Tanaka with Tanaka Investments. Please go ahead.
Me?
Hello.
Hey, Graham.
Hey, go ahead.
Graham, we got you on. Yep.
Yeah, hi. How are you? Thank you. This is a great call. Thank you very much for tying everything together, making it very understandable. I'm very encouraged, again, I have been, by your R&D pipeline, and it's appearing to be in itself kind of an ultimate renewable resource because you keep adding molecules in and pulling new ones out. And what my question is, how much faster can this renewable resource produce new molecules? It appears to me that you're coming out with, I think you said, six this year, and two or three per year in the future. It looks to me like you have the potential to generate more than that in say next year and the following year. And then secondly, you typically like to have 20 molecules in the pipeline. I'm wondering if you might expand that in the future. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, I'll hit the pipeline as far as number of molecules, and then Sunil, I'll leave it to you to talk about the speed and your vision, which I wholeheartedly support. Look, I think regarding the pipeline, it is actually much more important to get quality right than quantity. What I mean by that is picking the right molecules and the right partners matters a lot. And a lot of that is really about our understanding of the end market and the connection to the technology's ability to win in that end market. So, you know, adding another 20, that's the easy part. Getting 20 that can actually be delivered, being delivered on target, and actually start contributing to revenue and margin quickly, that's the hard part. So I wouldn't, as much as I'd love to say, hey, we'll double the pipeline next year, I don't want to set that expectation. I want to set an expectation that our pipeline will continue to be focused, highest quality in the industry, which results in successful product launches that deliver strong revenue growth and make both our partners and us happy. Sunil?
Yeah. Hey, Graham, thanks for that question.
Yeah.
The way I think about this problem is, you know, I don't necessarily want to just increase the size of the pipeline. I would like, we are trying to make it more efficient, right? Now, we've talked about taking a molecule to the pilot plant in a year or less. In some cases, we've done it in 6 months or less. Theoretically, you know, you should be able to do this in a few months, I mean, 2 to 3 months. And I think we have the technology platform to do that. So the question isn't, you know, how big or how fast you can do it. You know, the question is, can you do it in 2 months or 3 months? And there's data that we can be collecting so that, you know, let's say in the future we go after a molecule, a single design is all it takes. A single design, a single strain is all it takes to successfully produce a molecule. Are we there yet? No. But we're definitely on the way there. That's the vision. That's how I would like to see our R&D, PD, and manufacturing groups heading towards. So, you know, size of the R&D pipeline, yes, but really, let's talk about how efficient it can get. And so that's where my head is at right now.
That's really terrific, and I appreciate your comment on the success rate. It appears you've had a very high success rate, which some have not been very sure about. Other analysts and other investors have not been sure about, but it appears that you've had close to 100% success rate for the last few years. And with these new asset sales, the four possible asset sales, it appears to me that you're getting much, much greater industry awareness in what you are doing, the value of what you're doing, and the importance to them as potential partners or buyers of the assets. So my question is, as the publicity expands, and you will probably get more interest, and in the next year or two, where do you see yourselves as far as how many other assets you may have to sell? It appears to me you may not need to sell other assets. You may be able to keep more as Amyris owned molecules and yeast strains. Thank you.
Look, Graham, great observations, and I'd make a few points. When you think about our current operating performance, we don't see a need to sell assets, which is different than should we be opportunistic, and then who is the natural owner for some of the molecules. So the way I think about it is, like, we've demonstrated an ability to create a lot of value after a molecule is in market and established. So I don't see a, design, scale, sell. I see design, scale, produce. And then once the molecule has established market leadership, ask ourselves the fundamental question, are we the natural owner, or is it a peak valuation and an opportunity to monetize? And we're going to keep doing that on a consistent basis, because I think that's just the right thing to do from a business perspective, not necessarily connected to we need the cash from that molecule. So I think that's just an important point. Look, regarding the valuation, I did not expect for us to be where we are in valuation, and I think there are two key factors. The world is transitioning fast, and this year has been an acceleration of this issue to natural, sustainably sourced ingredients for a lot of the personal care and consumer products around the world. And we have some of the best technology to do that, and we're seeing that prove out. And I think the way that that's been proved out is the number of interested buyers and the number of people that approached us regarding the assets that are in play are at a greater level than we had ever experienced or expected. And that's made, again, the process a much better one for us to be able to manage. So I hope that helps. It's the world shifted. We're beneficiaries of that based on what our platform does and is, and that's been kind of like very fortunate for us.
Well, related to that valuation, is that I can sort of append this question on valuation and corporate sort of strategic goals possibly changing as you become more self-financing. And maybe this is really for Han, is, as you generate a better balance sheet, cash flow, earnings, and that kind of thing, what is your observation? What do you think is the biggest challenge for the company? We've been talking here about opportunities. What's the biggest challenge, either financially or otherwise? Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Graham. Great question. The way I look at it is really about, and we're going down this path of being clear about the choices and priorities we make in terms of the markets we serve. As John said, we do believe that, thinking about developing, scaling, commercializing these molecules is part of our business model, and monetizing it is also part of our business model, and we see that going forward. But I think really the focus, and John mentioned it in some of his prepared remarks, around beauty, personal care, and healthcare, where we will have a keen focus in terms of what we believe with clean chemistry we can contribute to those markets, and then invest accordingly. So I think it's really about the right choices, the right priorities, deploy our investments accordingly, and obviously for maximum impact in terms of contributing to the sustainable solutions in the marketplace, and equally to valuation. And that's how I see it.
Yeah. Hey, Han, I just want to build one point that connects to what you just said. I think focus is our biggest risk and opportunity, right? And like a great example, just in the last couple of weeks, I've been testing our new hair products, the shampoo, the conditioner, and some of the scalp oils we're actually taking to market. And very soon, you're going to see us announce an amazing partnership with a very popular person with great hair to actually take to market what, you know, based on the performance of these hair products, is the best performing hair products in the world. And like, I look at that, like the hair product brand, I look at what we're doing in color, like the number of retailers who want to carry our color line because of the clean nature, the aesthetics of it, how beautiful they are, and the fact that they want Rosie's brand. Like the assets we're building and the ability to really accelerate growth by focusing and delivering a great experience with the best chemistry, I think is really what I see as the greatest opportunity. And the risk is to get distracted by the next shiny object. We really cannot let that happen.
Well, thank you very much for explaining, giving us the scientific background and logic for this, and to talk about your opportunities and challenges. I think it's terrific. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Graham. Appreciate
it. Thank you, Graham.
The next question will be our last phone question, as we need to turn to some of the questions submitted through the webcast. And the final phone question will come from Rick Schottenfeld with Schottenfeld Opportunities Fund. Please go ahead.
Hey, guys. Congratulations. This was a great presentation and a great day. The question is sort of around the last two questions, which is, you know, with these private market valuations of 15 times revenue for molecules, have there been other transactions that sort of establish that as the market clearing level for your IP? And is it fair then to look at, you know, this year's crop of molecules and say that, you know, the six new molecules you're introducing now are going to do, you said revenues have doubled, so almost $60 million. That would basically imply that just the six molecules are your total market cap right now. Is that a fair way to look at the company right now? And are these valuations pretty consistent?
Hey, Rick, by the way, thanks for being on the call. And I'll break the questions into two answers, okay? First, I'm not going to actually comment on the market asset valuation because the disconnect is so ridiculous that, and I think, like, to be fair, the disconnect is there because, you know, we haven't had visibility and some people thought, you know, we couldn't actually pay off our own debt. I mean, I know it's ridiculous, but it's rational. It's kind of what you would see if you read our financials. The good news is that's never been a problem. And better news is we're now fully funded and have complete visibility in servicing our own debt. And more importantly, investing and growing without having to issue new shares or take on new debt. And that's a great place to be. Your valuation point regarding the assets is really important. You're absolutely right. There have been several transactions this year. Most recently, a Croda acquisition and a Symrise acquisition that really helped us establish the valuation for the molecules we're selling. And the way to think about it is, this is not true for all the molecules, but in general, the molecules we're selling at about 20 times, roughly, plus or minus, 20 times 2021 operating income for those molecules. And we think of that as fair market value based on the transactions that we're seeing. Now, if you add the long-term royalty and if you add some of the other sources of cash that these partnerships are bringing to the table as part of these contracts, it's actually more than that. But if you look at just the rough face value without looking at some of the long-term payouts, that's about what we've based the valuation on. And I shouldn't say based because obviously these were tough negotiations, but those recent transactions were very helpful. I hope that helps, Rick, in thinking about what's happened in the market and how those valuations got established.
So that kind of begs a question here, which is now that you've established this sort of new source of funds that we hadn't considered before, And with the public market giving you basically a 3 multiple on revenues, would you consider offsetting some of the dilution with buybacks if you know, you get to a position where your balance sheet can support them?
Look, too early to make comments on that. I mean, at this point, like, we have so much to execute operationally. I would tell you that, you know, after Han has an opportunity to breathe a bit and process all this, I'd expect, you know, sometime maybe in our first quarter earnings call to really be able to talk to that more intelligently than just giving you a quick answer. So for now, I'll leave that alone. Han, I don't know if you have a different view on that.
No, I would concur with that. I think let's land these transactions, finalize as we've outlined them, and then take a good sharp look at next steps.
Well, congratulations, guys. It was a great accomplishment.
Thanks, Rick.
Thanks, Rick. Look, I think your question obviously has been in our minds, especially as you look at what our cash balances end up resulting in as a result of all this over the next few years. But the opportunities are also pretty significant. So we want to make sure we're wise, especially with the amount of return we're generating. Like, another way to think about it is we're generating about 11 times return on some of these assets for cash invested over the last 4 years. So the ability to generate returns is pretty significant, and we need to be thoughtful about how we use proceeds. So I think we're going to move to questions that came in, right, Time?
Yeah, we're going to do. We're looking at the clock here, and we very much appreciate everybody staying with us here. We have a lot of interest and a lot of folks online, so that's been great. We're going to wrap it up, though, so we'll take one more question that we see online here, and I'm going to read it out, and I'm going to direct it at Sunil. So in five or 10 years, will Amyris continue to lever the same workhorse organisms? Just do it better? Or should we expect a broader range of host organisms to exploit different biological pathways? Sunil?
Yeah, answer is actually both. So we will continue to drive innovation and increasing the rate of progress in, say, our workhorses like Saccharomyces. But we have already expanded that capability to other microorganisms. I do believe that it is important to ensure that the pipeline is flexible enough to accommodate these other microbes, because Saccharomyces may not be the best host for every product that's out there and every market. At the end of the day, this is going to be driven, of course, again, like I said, keep the end in mind, right? So if your final manufacturing, if we judge that that molecule is better produced in a microbe like, say, you know, I'll pick an example, Bacillus, for example, that's where we'll go after. And we have invested effort in ensuring that the pipeline does translate from Cerevisiae to a host of other microorganisms. So definitely the answer is actually both. Improve what we have today and continue to improve other microorganisms at the same time.
Okay, that's great. John, did you want to make some closing comments perhaps?
Yeah, let me wrap it up, and I'll pick up right where Sunil left off. And Sunil, it's been a pleasure having you on. I missed us not being in the office and interacting more. So, and look, I think there are several points that Sunil just made that I want to just wrap up with. The first is this idea of single design to scale is actually like the idea. And to really get single design to scale means having so much data that you can just really put in what chemistry you need, press a button, design happens, you put it through the robotics, you get a strain, and that strain scales. That is what we're all building for, and that is really the dream for synthetic biology, and I think we're nearer that than anyone else, but there's still work to do because, like, getting the maps all identified, I think the analogy Sunil used of Google Maps, like, biology is very complicated. There's a lot of reactions that occur every time you make a modification to the coding of an organism, but that is really where we ought to go. Data is the key, and we've got the right tool set and the right scientists and talent to get there. I think second, the last point Sunil made, and part of single design to scale is actually using the right organism for the right chemistry. And I think that is kind of the next evolution. It's not a single host that does everything. It's actually figuring out the right host for the right kind of chemistry based on what that chemistry is about. So we're on our way, long ways to go, and the focus in the near term is making sure we're working on the things we have being as effective and efficient as possible so we continue being the most productive company in our sector. I'd like to thank you to everyone, actually, for joining us today and for your continued interest and support. If we did not get to your question, please follow up with our investor relations team. I know Peter DiNardo will be more than happy to get on it right away and work with Argo to make sure we're connecting with you directly. And we wish everyone a very happy holiday season, and please stay safe and healthy, because we'd love to see you and your families in the new year. Thanks again for taking time to be with us today.
Dan, thank you, sir. The conference has now concluded. Thank you for attending today's presentation. You may now disconnect.